I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive. And you may think that the 2020 presidential race is crowded already. Well, how many of you remember who you voted for president in 1976? Well, I know some people know who they voted for. Many listeners probably weren't even born yet. Of course, Jimmy Carter won the nomination that year and became president, beating out about a dozen more traditional liberal contenders, including Mo Udall, Birch Bayh, Sergeant Shriver, Frank Church, and Jerry Brown. There were also conservatives Lloyd Benson and Scoop Jackson and Robert Byrd, who was some of both, and Milton Schapp as well. The candidate for whom I and many others of my friends in particular enthusiastically voted for is Oklahoma Senator Fred Harris, who is our guest today. I enthusiastically voted for him. He stood out as the only populist in the race, and I thought that gave him a substantial leg up. Well, here we are at the start of the 2020 presidential race, and David Leonhardt of the New York Times wrote about economic populism. He said, "The Democrats' most effective political strategy, populism, is a winning issue like no other." End of quote from David Leonhardt. To say Fred Harris was ahead of his time is a massive understatement. He was, in some ways, I hope it's okay to say this, Bernie Sanders decades before Bernie Sanders. I still have his campaign slogan, the slogan poster, and the slogan on there is, "The issue is privilege." The challenges Fred Harris sought to address some 40 years ago remain unmet and in many cases have worsened. Mainstream Democrats tend to shy away from issues of economic fairness that he took on head on. I believe that if Democrats pick up the economic populist mantle this year and connect with average income Americans, we can and will win and make America America again. I'm very pleased and honored to have with us on Keeping Democracy Alive, former U.S. Senator Fred Harris. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Bird. Thank you for your friendship and your support all those years ago, and for what you're doing now. And thanks for having me on.
We're all in it together. There's no I in team, you know, all that stuff. For those who may not know, Senator Fred Harris is a widely published author and professor emeritus of political science at the University of New Mexico, where he continues some teaching in the University of New Mexico Fred Harris Congressional Internship Program. He was twice elected from Oklahoma as a progressive and reform-minded U.S. senator from 1964 to 1971 and was a most active member and is now the only surviving member of President Johnson's National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, also known as the Kerner Commission, which came into being at Harris's urging. He was chair of the Democratic Party from 1969 and 1970, and he caused reform of the party to make it democratic and fully representative of women and minorities. He was thereafter an unsuccessful but quite influential 1976 populist Democratic candidate for president of these United States. Fred Harris has been a Fulbright scholar in Mexico, a visiting professor at the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, Mexico's national university, and has taught and lectured extensively throughout Latin America, Europe, and Asia. He continues to be a citizen and political activist and has produced 20 nonfiction books on politics, government, and policy, including The New Populism and, as co-editor, the recently published Healing Our Divided Society, a 50th anniversary update of the 1968 Kerner Report. It's hard to believe that was 50 years ago, but it was. Well, thanks again for being with us. Populism.
You bet.
What is populism? It's a word we hear from time to time, and I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. How would you define populism?
Well, I have defined it a long time ago, 1973, in a book I wrote called The New Populism. Basically, it opposes the concentration of economic power, which translates into concentrated political power. It's for a more fair distribution of wealth and income and power. That's the original populism. which was a kind of an agrarian revolt in the country.
Yes.
And it's what I think real populism is today.
And it is certainly still there. And I wonder, as you know, a student of history, just for fun, I wonder, I get the sense that populism, the populist tradition, might actually go back to the Shays and Whiskey Rebellions, which, what do you think about that, Senator?
Well, I think that's true, and it's not exactly with a term, probably.
Right.
But that was an uprising, and it was an agrarian uprising. People came home from the Revolutionary War, farmers in western Massachusetts, and they found that the banks and the people with economic power had won the war. They found banks foreclosing on them. They couldn't. The price of their goods, their products had gone way down. Interest rates had gone way up, and they felt like they'd fought in the war, but they'd lost the war. And in that case, they took the guns that they'd brought home from the war and marched on the courthouses.
Well, I had a professor many years ago who said, and I think this is quite true, that politics is the economy of violence, and sometimes people do take up guns. Well, continuing on a little bit of the history of populism, something called prairie populism in the Midwest, where Democrats haven't done well lately. There was Bob La Follette, Fightin' Bob La Follette, J. William Fulbright. Tell us about prairie populism, and you're from Oklahoma, so talk about that, if you would, please.
Well, the Lawrence Goodwin wrote a book some time ago that talks about the history of of the populist movement and populism, and you've identified a part of it. For example, prairie populism, and you might call it in Wisconsin with Robert La Follette. Oklahoma, at the statehood in 1907 in Oklahoma, then the strongest party was the Populist Party. Probably second was the Socialists. Yeah. Third were the Democrats, and then the Republicans last.
Wow.
There was, for example, in Oklahoma, on the eve of World War One, or as World War One began, a thing that came to be called the Green Corn Rebellion.
Huh.
It was a populist uprising that had in it American Indians, African Americans, white workers, and others. Women were very active in it.
Wow.
It started out as an anti-draft movement and spread from that. But in all over the country, the populist party and the populist movement started as an agrarian effort, as farmers saw that they were really at the mercy of the banks and the middleman, and that their economic power made them weak politically. That is, their lack of economic power made them weak politically as well as economically, and they organized to try to do something about it.
That's interesting. I had never heard of the Green Corn Rebellion. I will certainly have to read about that. And so much of our history is based around that time. And certainly Bob La Follette and many others of the prairie populists strongly opposed U.S. entry into the war over there. They thought it was for protecting royalty, which kind of it was.
You look back on it now and you think, what a mistake it was for us to get involved in that terrible war. And
yes,
you think about the millions of lives that were ruined and lost, both here and in Europe.
Yeah.
It's a war we never should have gotten into, and so I think those people were quite right.
Oh, yes.
In that kind of revolt against the draft.
These days, one doesn't think of the heartland as a hotbed of populist uprising against, you know, the banks and the economic powers and the concentration of wealth. But that's what it was. It really happened in the heartland, the Democrat Farm Labor Party. It was all there. And It's changed quite a bit since then. And what has happened to the Democratic Party, do you think? I mean, Hillary lost in 2016 to everybody's absolute shock and dismay and substantial, you know, individual depression ever since then. I get the sense that she came across as kind of entitled, and that the party shifted in the 1990s with the Democrat Leadership Council and just went for the Wall Street big money and kind of gave up, you know, its populist labor farm roots. What do you think happened to the party, and what contributed to Hillary losing, do you think?
Well, you know, I was once the national chairman of the Democratic Party.
Yes, sir.
And as you mentioned in the introduction, I appointed a reform commission headed by Senator George McGovern.
Yeah.
And I made up the membership of that commission in such a way as to assure the reforms which they eventually came up with, which required affirmative action for women and minorities and democratic processes in all of the operations of the party, including the selection of delegates. I wrote about that in a book I called Now is the Time, A New Populist Call to Action. Populism is for people power, and what we wanted to do in that case with the Democratic Party was to make it live up to what it called itself, democratic. And after I was chairman, they began to monitorize the national conventions so that there were these lavish receptions and so forth for people who gave big sums of money. And it became more and more in favor, as far as the platform is concerned, of progressive proposals, but really it's sort of leanings primarily because of the financing, where more and more toward financial interests and those with concentrated economic power. That was a great shame, and I think now we're moving back in the right direction.
I think so too. I think we've come a long way, and the party that I have always loved, the party of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, shifted. I don't think he'd recognize a lot of the corporate Democrats, the so-called centrists. And, you know, I think it's important to win. I must say, especially now. My goodness. And I wonder, have we gotten stuck on social issues and purity and away from the economic issues that people care more about? It's kind of seen as a bit of elitism to get stuck on this purity of social issues, which, I mean, I'm certainly very much pro-choice and, you know, pro-equal rights for everybody. That's extremely important. But I wonder if in doing so, we've sort of left out some of the people in the middle, like from the old heartland and from, you know, Oklahoma.
You know, people speak of derisively of identity politics. That's people generally who are not supportive of the rights of women and minorities. And so they say, well, you know, that's a very bad thing, identity politics. But the Democratic Party is founded on the idea of equality and equality of opportunity. That's what America believes in. So
yes,
you can't turn our backs.
No.
On that kind of identity politics, as it's called. But there's no need to, because I believe, as Paul Wellstone put it, and as my friend, the populist agriculturalist leader down in Texas, Jim Hightower, my old campaign manager, puts it, everybody does better when everybody does better. and I think that We can show, for example, that you can pull people together of all kinds of backgrounds around economic opportunity and around economic fairness and a fair distribution of wealth and income and power. I've done it in various races. These are the popular issues now.
Yes.
85% of those who are going to be running for Democratic nomination for president believe in the kinds of things that we stand for,
yes,
and that the public stands for, raising the minimum wage, tax fairness, and so forth, fair trade, not the kind of trade we've had, trade agreements we've had in the past. One of the problems has been in the past is and still is to some degree, Republicans running for office really appeal to only one constituency. Democrats, very often, if they're progressive or populist Democrats, as most of them are now, they have two constituencies they've always had to appeal to. That is the voters, on the one hand, and those who will give them some campaign money and finance their campaigns. And often they don't have the same interests. That's why the Supreme Court's decisions, Citizen United and others, knocking down the idea of controlling campaign contributions and so forth, is so basically wrong from the standpoint of what's good for America. But, you know, people say I'm an inveterate optimist, and, and really that's true, but I think it's an intellectually sound optimism when I say that the Internet has really changed things for Democrats, liberal or progressive or populist Democrats, in that if they really believe in something and they are strong about it, strong in their advocacy and so forth, you can use the Internet today to finance your campaign with small contributions. First, Howard Dean, I guess, showed us that more than anyone else, and then Obama did the same. So I think that that's a very great development for populist, progressive Democrats.
Yeah, I've always hoped that you know, not just having three networks and those as the sources of news, that having more choices could lead to actually more democracy. And I agree with you, Senator. I think it's actually having that effect, and that's a very, very positive thing. More democracy through the Internet. For those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. I'm very honored to have with us former chair of the Democratic Party, 1976 candidate for president, Oklahoma Senator Fred Harris. And we're talking about prairie populism and what the Democrats can do now to win. Now, of course, Trump somehow used the word populism, and I think it's been abused, the word populism. It can be manipulated. Actually, writing in the Atlantic magazine, Yasha Monk and Jordan Kyle wrote that either democracy is in the midst of an unexpected global retreat or witnessing a course correction in which citizens are finally holding global elites to account for their failures. What's your reaction to that opinion from the Atlantic magazine, Senator?
I think that's a really important thing to consider what they say. The word populist, you know, maybe we're going to have to abandon it. Like for a while, you know, the word liberal was demonized to the degree that people began to call themselves progressives instead of
liberal.
Liberal, and that may be true. Because of the way the populist word is used. For example, in regard to President Trump, Paul Krugman wrote in the New York Times that when the media uses the word populist to describe Trump, they're in effect complicit in his lie, and especially when they do it in the context of supposedly objective reporting. Roger Cohen, also in the New York Times, has written about this, that very often populism is used by commentators and pundits and so forth in a dismissive way. And it's used that way for everything that metropolitan elites, he says, can't quite find the energy to understand. And so, for example, Cohen goes on to say, Donald Trump's movement is populist, for example. The supporters of Britain's exit from the European Union, they're populist. Two very different parties in coalition governing Italy are populist. The Economist refers to a populist virus The Atlantic, as you say, to demagogic populists. The Washington Post to populism is sweeping the Middle East. The New York Times to Kurdish populist movement and a Thai populist movement and so forth. By and large, what they mean by populist in those cases is demagogic. And it really sort of reflects the superior view, as Roger Cohen again has said, that these deluded plebs seldom encountered in person have got it wrong. I think that that's true. It's an elitist kind of use of that term. So maybe we should just call ourselves progressives or be clear, call ourselves populist progressives so that it's not that kind of popular use of the word populist in many quarters.
I think the term liberal, from what I can tell, it got sort of a bad name in 1988 when the people running against our nominee, Michael Dukakis, had that racist TV ad about Willie Horton. And
yes,
that I think people understood liberal to mean soft on crime and letting bad guys out. And we're taking it back. I think the word liberal is coming back into fashion. Right? Defining words is just so, as you know, important. And, you know, as you say, it's been manipulated, the word populism. And it amazes me how authoritarians like Donald Trump can get away with having this image of populism. So, I mean, how does he do that? Is it his cultural populism? I mean, let's talk about that a little bit. Economic populism as compared to cultural populism.
Well, that's partly true. You know, of course, those with the economic power have always, particularly concentrated in the Republican Party, they've always used cross-cutting issues to keep people from voting their own economic self-interest.
Yes.
You know, against the communists or for law and order or against, they used to say it quite out loud and now much more subtly, against African-Americans or against these Mexicans who are trying to get into our country,
really?
The way Trump uses that. And so we've always had those cross-cutting issues used as a way to, for example, a fellow I like a great deal, Thomas Franks, who wrote about what's the matter with Kansas? How come Kansas, he says, vote against their own economic self-interest?
Really?
And that is a basic question. He says in a later book, Thomas Franks does, a book called Listen, Liberal,
yes,
that one reason they do is we don't press enough that we're interested in working class white people, particularly those, for example, with less than a high school education or less, many of whom, and rural people who were Trump supporters. They, for example, and I think here's a good example of it from my own life. I was a member of the President's Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, the Kerner Commission.
Yes.
Which, as you said in the introduction, reported a little over 50 years ago now, almost 51 years ago. And we said, you know, that America is moving toward two societies, one black, one white,
yes,
separate and unequal. And we recommended very strong national programs to combat racism and poverty. But my dad, who was a small farmer in southwestern Oklahoma then, has about a third grade education, or had about a third grade education, loved me, I should say. He's passed on now.
I would think.
But the way he heard the Kerner report was, Mr. Harris, out of the goodness of your heart, you ought to pay more taxes in order to help poor black people who are rioting in New York.
Oh, my.
And he didn't know that what we recommended, we said out loud, applied to people like him, too, not just to black people. And our message never got across as well as it should have. And I think that we've been derelict in the Democratic Party of making clear that we believe, as Sherrod Brown of Ohio says, in the dignity of work, people who work for a living. and we're interested in them just as much as we're interested in women and minorities and so forth. And they themselves are working people, too.
Yes.
Whose interests are ought to be ours.
If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here on Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today, Senator Fred Harris, former chair of the DNC, candidate for president in 76, a guy who's still got a lot to say, a liberal populist from Oklahoma, deep red Oklahoma. How much has it changed, by the way, before we get back to, you know, what to do from here? Oklahoma is like, would anybody even, it seems deep red now. Am I misreading it? And why do you think that is?
No, you're not misleading about it. It was in the last two elections, the last three or so, most conservative state in the country. Mm. Obama, for example, did not carry a single county in Oklahoma. Mm. It was changing already by the time I was first elected to the United States Senate in 1964. But when I got involved in politics in Oklahoma, it was a state with very strong labor unions. And there was there had been mines, coal mines, lead and zinc mines and so forth that were organized, checkout counters and so forth in grocery stores were organized. Today, as you know, the private jobs that are organized, union jobs, in Oklahoma as well as in the country has shrunk to almost to something like 6%.
Wow.
And now the public unions are under great attack as well. In those beginning years for me in Oklahoma in politics, the Farmers Union, a socialist organization by and large for land reform, graduated land tax and so forth, was very strong because most of our farmers were small farmers, and that Farmers Union was a small farmer organization. They were highly influential politically. Today, the Farmers Union has largely disappeared in Oklahoma because the family farms have disappeared.
Yeah.
And then after I was in office, and I got elected, incidentally, when Lyndon Johnson got elected. He was a neighbor and was very popular in Oklahoma.
Oh, sure.
And I got elected, too, at a time when there was a public vote on right-to-work laws. And even though unions were shrinking in size and influence, that really brought them out. And their vote, their exceptionally large vote that year, was a help in getting me elected.
Uh-huh.
But unions declined, or organized labor numbers did. The Farmers Union largely disappeared. There was the rise of big oil, right-wing, largely evangelical, urban newspapers, all of that changed Oklahoma. And then once that change set in, the Democratic Party nationally didn't run any campaigns there anymore.
Mm.
You could, in a swing state like New Mexico, the airways were full, the political meetings were everywhere in the presidential campaigns, and you could walk across the line into Oklahoma,
forget it,
and you wouldn't even know a presidential campaign was going on. The Democratic Party simply abandoned those kinds of states. And so all those things changed Oklahoma. But Oklahoma's changing back now. There was a teacher strike which forced the legislature begin to try to fund a quality education in that state. They just elected a really progressive woman in a seat to Congress, in a seat in Oklahoma City that hadn't had a Democratic member of Congress since 1970.
Wow.
So things are changing somewhat. But our major problem, I think, that is progressives or populists, our major problem is that is communicating with people that ought to be in our coalition.
Yes.
Working class white people, particularly white men.
Mm-hmm.
They don't watch the same news, listen or read the same news. That puts a greater burden on us to communicate to them about their own self-interest.
Oh, for sure. And as you mentioned, I thought that was fascinating about your dad's take on the Kerner Commission. Fascinating. I think that's been very effective and very harmful, that somehow working white people believe that they're in competition with working black and Latino people. And you see a lot of that in the, I think, clearly racist hatred toward immigrants who, you know, we're all immigrants, let's face it. And, you know, the hatred that they think somehow they've been convinced that they're taking our jobs, and that they've pitted working people against working people. The right wing has been very effective at that. I wonder how we can deal with that.
Well, first of all, we got to want to. I think that there were, you know, people ask, why did Hillary Clinton lose?
Yes.
Well, if you have to answer, first of all, she didn't lose.
Well,
she won nationwide by about 3 million votes.
Right.
But secondly, there are three quick answers to that. Why did she lose the election?
Yeah.
That is in the Electoral College.
Yes, sir.
One is Putin, that massive campaign that they ran in this country for Trump and against Hillary Clinton. And secondly, Comey, that back and forth and terrible announcements that he made in regard to her and those emails. And thirdly, the Electoral College itself.
Yeah.
Those are the three quick reasons. But also, I know this. Now, Bill Clinton, for example, I know him, and I was with him back during that campaign in one little meeting, and he said when he got up to speak, he looked over at me, and he said, Fred, you and I know these people. He's talking about people that were for Trump. He said, we grew up with these people. We know these people. And we know that their lives are not very good. That there's, he didn't use the word economic security, but their problem is a very precarious economic security. And this, strangely enough, in the very same week, Hillary Clinton, his wife, got caught saying in a private meeting, something about half of the Trump supporters were a basket of deplorables.
Yes, big.
And I know for a fact that there were people high up in the strategy and tactics of her campaign who didn't think it was worthwhile or productive to really go after white men of high school education or less, working class white men. We'd better spend our time where we already have support and try to build it. They're wrong, and people are wrong today who think that we can win the presidential election by just ignoring those people. We have to speak to them. They were a central part of Franklin Roosevelt's coalition.
Absolutely.
We're not right away going to win a majority of them, but we're going to get our share. We must get our share in order to win. And they believe basically in the same things that we all believe in. That is that virtually all of the Democratic candidates and the Democratic platform, for example, Bernie Sanders said the Democratic platform was the most democratic in the history, most progressive in the history of the party. And that's true. And Elizabeth Warren said about Hillary, despite the fact there are several things we didn't like about her background and what she said and did, that she was the most progressive candidate for president the Democrats had ever nominated. Well, that's true. There's a great many of those what you call basket of deplorables who are our people, who believe in what we believe in, and they're entitled to be a part of our coalition, and we'll come along if we can just communicate with them. I know that's true. For example, in my own case, when I was running for president, I held a big rally down in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Hmm. And when I had a lot of my friends from the nearby Choctaw Indian Reservation and a lot of African-American friends and others who supported me, and a lot of my, what I laughingly called, redneck kinfolks. My dad came from Mississippi.
Uh-huh.
And I said to them when I got up to speak in Hattiesburg then, I said, I was in Minnesota in Minneapolis last night, and I told that crowd that I was on my way to Hattiesburg, Mississippi, where we were going to have the best-looking political rally ever put together, or the damnedest race riot, one or the other. And then I told them about a visit I made to Mississippi with a great aunt when I was 12 years old. And I stayed with some relatives, white relatives, a man and woman about in their late 40s, I suppose. They were living in what had been the old family home, which was one time pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And they had a black couple over one day. They spent the entire day cleaning that house. It was made of heartwood pine, so it wasn't painted inside. They washed down the walls with lye water. They washed all of the bedclothes, hung them out and outside to sun and to dry and so forth. This couple spent all day long from daylight to dark working, and my relatives paid them with a canned, home-canned jar of green beans and a bucket of ribbon cane molasses.
Ooh.
And I said to that Hattiesburg crowd, they didn't realize that that was why they were still working themselves for 25 cents an hour. And afterwards, I had an elderly relative of mine, gray-haired, came up to me, actually with tears in his eyes. And he said to me, "Fred, I've been waiting all my life to hear people talk like that. I know it can be done, and we can see it, too, from, I think, the work of one of the great people in America today, the Reverend William Barber."
Yes.
Who has put together what he calls a Moral Mondays.
Yes, sir.
To lobby the legislature in North Carolina, and that's a movement spreading around, and is also putting together another Poor People's March.
Mm-hmm.
And he's put together people, black and white, Indian, Hispanic, other minorities, women, LGBTQ plus community, all sorts of people. Around their common issues, and he shows that it works, that you can do that. I always say, the people in our coalition, they don't have to love each other. I wish they did, but all they have to do is recognize that if they get, they have common interests, and if they get themselves together, they're a majority.
Boy, that has been a challenge, you know. Normally, a president at least claims to try to unite the country, and this president obviously is aggressively and rather cruelly dividing people. It's about connecting. I've been amazed over the years seeing, you know, rundown mobile homes with big signs for, you know, some of the wealthiest people who don't give a darn about these people. Yet these this constituency, this demographic, they voted for Trump enthusiastically. How, what you're talking about, they should be with us, but we have not been communicating and connecting with them. How do we do that?
Yeah. Well, you know, what we've got to do is help them see that that false populism,
yes,
is really false.
Yes.
Progressive populism and that kind of false populism very often is based on the economic insecurity of the of their adherents, and that's the appeal. But they, generally, it's aimed toward, as enemies, the false populism is, the government, or to other groups like African Americans or Mexican immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas true or progressive populism, based upon the need for economic fairness, is aimed as sort of the enemies, those who
mm-hmm.
have the power,
mm-hmm.
and that ought to be more fairly shared.
The power of Wall Street, the power of the big banks, we've seen it again and again and again, and the average income people pay for it, and they get away with that. And it's amazing to me how the people that are getting most screwed are some of the staunchest defenders of that group. We have to connect with them, and I think it's starting to happen. With Trump talking about how great, you know, these huge profits, talking to farmers, it ain't going to happen. So hopefully
it's always a campaign question. Are we going to make this campaign decided on my issues or my opponent's issues? And
yes,
that's always true. So, for example, and I think as John Meacham has written in his latest book, the struggle in America is always between, say, the Martin Luther Kings on one hand and the David Dukes on the other. I mean,
yeah.
It's always this good and evil struggle, and it's an everyday struggle. I one time heard a guy who was a guitar player and a folk singer, and he spent a lot of time tuning up, of course, and he had this patter while he was tuning. And one thing I remember he said was, talking about his guitar, he said, if I ever get this thing tuned again, I'm going to weld it. And I think that's the way so many of us are. We think, well, now, wait a minute. And then there are a lot of white people who believe this. I know, well, civil rights, didn't we do all that? Or what about poverty? Well, didn't we already address that? Or we tried and we failed and you can't do it anyway. And what government does is always wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's what campaigns are about. Let's make it on my issues rather than those issues of those false populists. And David Leonhard, writing in the Times, I think, as you mentioned him earlier.
Yes, sir.
He said it right. That's the way we're going to win
in
2020.
I think so.
Making our campaign on economic populism and organizing it, as he says, around fighting for the little guy and gal, as he puts it. And most of the potential Democratic nominees could do so, as he said. It would be a campaign about Republican politicians and corporate lobbyists who are rigging the game, a campaign that promised good jobs, rising wages, decent health care, affordable education, and an end to Trumpian corruption. I think he's absolutely right, and the polls show it.
I think so. We just have to have some courage. And what's amazed me, how often mainstream Democrats, so-called mainstream Democrats, shy away from populism. They're afraid of it somehow. So they take this wishy-washy middle of the road, and as our mutual friend Jim Hightower said, in Texas, there's only two things in the middle of the road, dead armadillos and yellow stripes.
That's absolutely right. Jim Hightower, as you know, was, as I said earlier, my campaign manager for when I ran for president. He was asked that question by a reporter for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, said, is it true you were campaign manager for Fred Harris for president? And Hightower said, that's true. He said, I made Fred Harris what he is today, a college professor. But Jim is absolutely right. He's still fighting the battle.
Yeah.
Also, incidentally, I want to mention again Sherrod Brown. Sherrod Brown,
I think,
of Ohio. He's the best example of a successful practicing populist.
Yes, sir.
And he gets elected with the support of a lot of those Hillary unfortunately called a basket of deplorables. That is white men, working class men, and he gets elected in Ohio. Very strongly,
yes.
While the other officers in the state are going Republican. I think he is a really good example. You can say and run on exactly what you believe.
Yes,
economic populism or whatever we want to call it, these progressive positions, and win nationwide. As a matter of fact, you can't win otherwise. Democrats can't. And our main problem is communication. I think broadband internet's going to be really important all around the country in the rural areas as well. And more, I think people will become sophisticated in how to value the news that they're getting by that means. But, you know, we've had the campaigns this last go-round in Massachusetts for the Senate and in New York for the Senate, for example, where they didn't spend any money on television. They spent it on digital media.
It's amazing.
And that, I think, is more and more the wave of the future. And we've had so many campaigns now, like Beto's, Beto O'Rourke's for the Senate in Texas, and most lately Bernie Sanders' campaign for president last time, where they were able to use the internet to raise more than enough money to win. Bernie didn't lose because of lack of money, and neither did Beto.
No, that's true. There's other factors in it. What about, and again, if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here, talking on Keeping Democracy Alive, our guest today, former Senator Fred Harris, just a great American, what I think the Democratic Party, like kind of the soul of the Democratic Party. Pardon me for being, you know, effusive here, but hey, I feel it. We can't win by just being not Trump. We have to be for something. I think we would agree. The platform for 2020, people have to see where we are on tax fairness, health care, college financial aid, minimum wage, anti-corruption. I hope that our nominee and the party, as it moves along, and it'll be messy, it always is, can embrace these things. I think we can cut into it. What about the inevitable charges of class war?
Well, you know, there's always a class war. I mean, we've always had a class war. The trouble is, the wrong class has been losing it.
That's right.
And it's all, you know, people talk about class warfare are really the people that have been winning the war. They use that term derisively. I think it's important for us, as Thomas Frank points out in that book, What's the Matter with Kansas, for people to become class conscious, that know that their best allies, working class people, their best allies are downward and not upward in the class system.
Well, it does seem that, unlike, you know, the Western European countries, which have traditionally had class consciousness, that at least there's the promise of a middle class, and it seems like some of those people in what was unfortunately called a basket of deplorables identify with the wealthy people. They don't connect with people at their same income level. They want to get away from that. I think it's important that we recognize that, yeah, there has been a class war for a long time, and average people have been getting beat consistently, decade after decade, and we have to go for that. But, you know, when I grew up in the 50s, there was a very large, very strong middle class. It's been decimated. There's no middle class anymore. I'm hoping people can see that. Go ahead, Senator.
That's true. You know what? The problem often is that with the working class people, like my dad, for example, they fear that the government and us progressives. Now I can explain it to him, so he agrees with me. But their first response almost always is that you're giving money, you're giving help to people who don't deserve it.
Right, that's a good point.
And you know, there's a lot of feeling like that in the country that's based upon the kind of Reader's Digest things that Reagan used to say, you know, the fictional welfare mother who drives up in a Cadillac to get her food stamps or whatever, and which is absolute fiction. My dad, for example, I'm certain never voted for a Republican. He always voted Democratic. But he said to me one time about Nelson Rockefeller, when there was some question about Nelson Rockefeller might run for president, or he did actually, might be president. My dad said, well, you know, he at least he wouldn't have to steal. And I pointed out to him, I said, well, he didn't have to steal because his old daddy did.
That's right.
He had no common interest, really, with Nelson Rockefeller, my dad.
No, and, of course not.
And if you take some time at it, and they and you, your recipient of what you're saying believes in you, as my dad did me, they'd see that their interests were common with the poor people, not rich people, and that if we got together and made this the kind of egalitarian society that our founders had in mind, or many of them did, it'd be good for rich people too. I know that people would be less unwilling to pay taxes if they thought that it would provide that their taxes would provide for a society that was safe and secure and was in line with our ideals.
Well, as you say, if everybody does better, everybody does better. Well, how optimistic are you for the Democratic Party at this point? Have we learned some lessons? Do you think, I mean, I know there's a lot of resistance at the top.
You have to, the problem is, I used to head the National Democratic Party, and there is no such thing as the Democratic Party, you know.
That's for sure.
Our government is fragmented, of course, between states and federal, and then within the federal government, it's fragmented between the Congress and the presidency. And so you have to kind of think about what you're talking about when you say the Democratic
Well, the DNC.
Or the do you mean the Democratic voters when you say the Democratic Party? Or do you mean the Congress or the Democrats in Congress?
What about the DNC? They kind of set things up, you know, in 2016.
The platform of the Democratic Party and the opinion of a great majority of the Democrats, the Democratic voters, is a very progressive view.
Absolutely.
This is the Democratic Party today. I'm talking about the voters and
the ground,
the party organizations.
Yes.
That believe almost 100% with, say, Elizabeth Warren or with Sherrod Brown.
Yes, I think so, too. It's, the question is, you know,
and the activists, those who nominate our candidates, really, or have the most influence on the nomination process, their percentage is even greater than among the voters generally.
Well, that's true. I am optimistic. You sound optimistic. And I think we're coming together. Generally, we never learn from history, but I think maybe we've been shaken up so much by what's happened, by the shift of power to a very, very few people, that we can talk about this stuff. And that I have faith in, as you talk about, the ground level of the Democratic Party. I'm hoping we can do it. How optimistic?
I think we can, but we, as I said, we've got to want to, and we've got to realize that this has got to be a broad coalition, and also we've got to, get into. We got to understand people's insecurities.
True.
You think about, here's a person like my dad again. What a confusing world this looks like to people like him. We got the LGBTQ community. A lot of them will get elected to office. These women, for goodness sakes,
women
elected to office, and they used to talk about. For example, George Meany, who was head of the FL-CIO, had a when I was appointing that McGovern Commission. He didn't like the kind of people I was putting on it, and he had his COPE director call me every now and then, and he said at one time, and this is an actual quote, he said, you know, he's marrying the he's and the she's marrying the she's and these long-haired kids and these pushy women, you know, they can't be allowed to take over. Well, you know, and then for God's sake, you elect a black man president of the United States, and you see all of these brown people beginning to move into the country and so forth, and even elected to office. This is a confusing-looking world, and you put that together with a lot of economic insecurity, and you say, well, we've got to understand those people and talk to them about their self-interest.
Yes.
You know, this is the difference between, I should have said this earlier, this is the difference between populism, as my kind of populism, mm-hmm. and, say, the New Deal, liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
Franklin Roosevelt and Herbert Hoover both believed that people who are more well off ought to help people who are less well off. But they both really thought of that as a kind of a moral responsibility, sort of your Christian duty.
Uh-huh.
Hoover thought it could be done through churches and private organizations. Roosevelt thought the government ought to be the conduit for that, the instrument of that kind of charity. But he still thought of it as charity and a moral responsibility. Populism, on the other hand, talks to people's self-interest. Now, I think there is value and power in a moral movement and a moral approach on the basis of morality. But I think what really moves people and is really the correct, the right kind of appeal is one that says, do this because it's in your self-interest.
Yes.
There was an old study some long time ago, but I think it's still good, that looked at how politics is taught in grade schools that differ in the economic level of the families that the schools serve.
Yeah.
And it found that, for example, schools that served poor people, the kids of poor people, taught politics was a sort of a thing you ought to obey the law and support your officials. The politics that was taught for people in the middle or middle-income families and kids was you ought to be involved in politics because it's your duty.
Uh-huh.
You hear this on election day. Some announcers will say a kind of public service announcement. Today is election day. Don't forget to vote. Why? Why should I vote? Uh-huh. Well, because it's your duty. It's like it's your day to carry out the garbage.
Well, it's in your interest to do so. That's what we need to convince them.
In schools that served well-off families, they were taught that politics is the way you get or keep what's yours, your self-interest. New Deal liberalism appealed to people saying, well, let's vote this way for black people or whatever because it's your duty or because it's morally the thing to do.
But we're all in it together, but really.
Talk to people about their self-interest. That's true. I mean, like, for example, you say, well, why should I care about all those black kids in inferior, almost criminally inferior schools down in Mississippi? Well, they don't stay in Mississippi. A lot of them don't.
Yeah.
And they wind up, you can show people that it's a lot better to spend some money on early childhood education.
Absolutely.
And a lot cheaper.
Yes, sir.
To spend it on welfare and joblessness and prisons and so forth.
Well, I hope that a lot of your ideas make it into the platform of 2020. We are completely out of time, sir. Thank you so much. It's been a great, great discussion. Senator Fred Harris, thank you so much.